This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 19th of October 2010. And once again, I am joined on the line by the indubitable Bob Chapman. Mr. Chapman, of course, being a stockbroker from 1960 until he retired in 1988. And for 18 of those years, he owned his own brokerage firm and was the largest gold and silver stockbroker in the world during that time. His financial writings have appeared in numerous publications, and his newsletter or parts thereof are published on over 60 different websites each week and are read by over 10 million investors. Bob Chapman, it is always a pleasure to have you on, and it is absolutely a pleasure to have you on again tonight.
Well, thank you very much, and I really enjoy your show, as you well know, and I wish we did more of them, actually, even though I get a full plate all the time. But the ideas seem to spring between you and I, and I love that.
Absolutely, as do I, and I'm sure the listeners pick up on that as well. And we will try to have more conversations, although we both have extremely a lot on our plates. But let's just get right into it tonight then, because I want to break down the ongoing foreclosure crisis that's unfolding right now, the drama of the robo-signing and all these new revelations of outright fraud that are coming out. And I'd like to start from sort of the beginning of the story for those out there who might not have been following it. So why don't you break down for us what this fraud is about and how it was revealed and really what the fallout is likely to be?
Well, lawsuits were filed by people who were in foreclosure saying that the people who were foreclosing on them didn't in fact own the property or couldn't prove that they owned the property that people were being ejected from. And it goes back to a couple of things. Number one, the illegal system that was set up by lenders for the most part called MERS, which is the Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems. And they use this to do their execution of foreclosure. The problem was that, number one, they were closing upon people over state lines, and they had to have notarization that they could do such a thing. And this document of transfer had to be signed by the seller and the buyer. In this case, the bank, the lender, was the one that signed, and the one who was supposed to leave the home would have to sign as well. And secondarily, the lenders had sold the ownership of the mortgages, although they were still designated as the collectors of the money to be paid in mortgage payments. And they had to produce a deed when they went to foreclose, and they couldn't because they either lost it because the whole thing was such a mess, or it was embedded in a bond which had already been sold along with hundreds of thousands of other mortgages. And so that's the basic tenet to the whole problem. They, in fact, eventually, the lender didn't own the loan, and the loan went off someplace else within that bond, and those bonds were sold over and over again. And so they have a very, very difficult time locating ownership, which would be the deed. And so that's why people have filed lawsuits of fraudulent conveyances, basically what it's called. And it means that the foreclosure proceedings could be subject to a legal challenge, which they have been. And the other question is, could foreclosure be done that have been done since 2007 be nullified? Could they be brought back to the living, so to speak? Could the owners of the foreclosed properties back to 2007 could they in fact go to the lender and say you illegally did this? And the answer is probably yes. And so the banks have obviously deliberately broken the laws, and they are subject to fines for that, although they say that they didn't do that, and they may very well have to settle with people who they've thrown out of their homes, illegally actually, and so the numbers, the banks are going to probably get hit with over $10 billion of losses. And there's four or five major entities involved. You know the major banks who are involved. And so I think that the banks think, as lenders, that like government today and Wall Street and banking, they can do anything they want. And bank, Wells Fargo said they haven't done anything wrong, and it's been proven that they have already in court. Secondly, Bank of America has said today that they are not going to continue to impose moratorium on foreclosures. They're going to go right ahead and do them anyway. They do not care one bit what the law says. They think that they are a law unto themselves, and they're going to get backed up by somebody they paid off, the person who calls himself the President of the United States, and all these congressmen who they lavish with monetary gifts for their campaigns. And so that is more or less where the whole thing stands. And I don't think we've heard the end of it yet. They may be using much bravado in pursuing their own ends in this thing, but I think they're going to get cut off at the pass. I think they're going to have to back off on going forward and doing what they were doing before.
You know, I've been reading up on this for a few days now and trying to get my head around it, but the size and the scale and the scope of what we're facing here is still staggering to me. And you hit on one of the, or quite a few of the key topics there, but one of the key aspects of this is the fact that a lot of the title's ownership is in question because of the way that these mortgages were not just being sold by the lenders, but were being bundled up as mortgage-backed securities and sold and resold. So perhaps we can go a little bit into that and how that relates to this whole mess.
Well, the securitization process was something relatively new to the brokerage firms and the banking and even insurance in this particular area. Debt had always been packaged and sold, credit card debt, automobile, and truck debt. And then you had the commercial paper market, although it's collateralized with some sort of other paper. In other words, let's say that you're a company and you want to fulfill an order for a million widgets, and you just got the order, and you do have good collateral, but you would like to borrow, say, 3 or 3.5% monies to be able to complete the widget contract, which would be done in 3 months. You know that because that's what you do for a living. And so they would go to the commercial paper market and they would borrow the money. And sometimes they would put up treasuries, or they might even put up these MBS and ABS and CDOs, which are bonds which contain mortgages. So these syndicated mortgages were used for a number of things, collateral as well as anything else. And so when they were rated AAA for the most part, and they weren't AAA. And the agencies rating them, S&P, Moody's, and Fitch, mostly S&P and Moody's. The proper rating probably would have been a triple B, and the difference between a 10 and a 4 on a scale. And so in collusion and in conspiracy with the creators of these syndicated tranches, as they're called, bonds, they were mislabeled in the first place. Second of all, the bonds consisted of mortgages, but sometimes they would have pieces of mortgages. And in order to enhance the bond itself, they might take a portion of mortgages and only inject into it the part of the mortgage where the payment was made, and the capital asset of the mortgage itself might go into another syndicated bond. And so this is why it's so hard to find out where everything is without going back through everything, that could, which could take them 10 years, because there's so many of them as well. And so these bonds were sold. They were sold at par, which is $1,000. And they immediately started to sell at discount. And they were, the bonds were selling at $800 instead of $1,000. And that went on for some time. And then what happened was that these bonds, which had been sold 60% in Europe, for the most part 40% in the United States, they began to have problems. And the problems were the falling in the value of real estate and the real estate industry itself. And so they continued to fall in value. That brought about the credit crisis 3 years ago. And in that crisis, what happened was that a lot of these lending institutions had these syndicated bonds on their books because they hadn't been able to sell them all. They didn't have enough time. The real estate market sort of like jumped up out of, like Jack out of the Jack-in-the-Box, and they were caught flat-footed. And so this led to the insolvency of all of these banks. That was ameliorated by the Federal Reserve and the Treasury through things such as TARP. And what government did was lend money in an impossible low rate to these lending institutions. And they were able to fake it, so to speak, and stay in business. And the Fed arranged all sorts of nuances where they would make profits. And, of course, the people who owned the Fed were the people who were in the most trouble. J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and prior to that, Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, which went bankrupt. And so you had this foul kettle of fish, and how do you get rid of it? Well, the buyer of last resort was the Fed. Their announced purchase this past year was $1.7 trillion in what they call toxic bonds, which are these bonds that contain mortgages. And so the Fed bought these at, we don't know at what price because they won't tell us, but it's assumed that they bought them for 80 cents on the dollar. And now the same banks that sold them to the Fed are going to buy them back to loosen up and clear the Fed's balance sheets. The problem is they're going to buy them back for 20 cents on the dollar, which is their real market value. The 60 cents in between is going to be borne by the U.S. taxpayer. They don't tell people that.
And to top it off, the 20 cents that they are paying is going to be largely coming from the QE2 that the Fed's using, creating the money out of nothing to inject liquidity into the system. So it all really comes from the taxpayer at the end of the day.
That's right. And also will increase the amount of money available to the banks, and it will stabilize them even more from the terrible situation that they were in this, and essentially they still are in. And so what overall has happened is that these mortgage bonds were the underlying force which created the problem as a result of what the banks had done in the formation of lending to those most of whom shouldn't have had loans in the first place, and the prudent lender's not supposed to do that, as we know. They make mistakes. We all do. But that was deliberate. They just wanted to get everybody in the house and at the same time make a pile of money, which they did. And so they let all these loose ends fly at loose ends. And what has happened is we have the crisis, and part of the crisis is not only not doing the paperwork properly, not having title, having sole title, acting as agent, when in fact the title is floating around the world someplace in the form of a bond with a whole bunch of other mortgages. And so it's not easy for the public to understand. And that's understandable. And they, the banks, the lenders, they do that so that people don't understand, because they don't want them to understand, because they've been caught with their hand in the cookie jar. So
that is so right. That is exactly right. And that, I think that speaks volumes, because some of this gets lost on some people because of the jargon and other things that are injected into this. But at base, all this is one giant Ponzi scheme.
It is. And, you know, fractional banking itself is. Historically, they've used 9-to-1. And that means for every dollar they have in deposit or in assets, they can lend 9. And that's been considered prudent over the centuries. Now, when you see a lending institution, in this case, many of them, when you see them lending 70 times, and that's what they were doing, you know that's totally imprudent. Number one, yes, it's for profit. But number two, it makes you wonder why prudent bankers would do such a thing unless they wanted to bring the system down. They're still leveraged at 40-to-1. And that's being offset by the money that they borrow from the Fed. Here's another cute wrinkle to this thing. The Fed lends these legacy money center banks money at 0% interest. And then these banks put it on the balance sheet, and they lend it back to the Fed at 2.5% interest. That 2.5%, which certainly shouldn't be paid to the lending institutions, the banks, comes from the money that would be paid by the Fed back to the Treasury, because the Fed doesn't make money. They have expenses, and all the money that's left over goes back to the Treasury. That sounds good in theory. But in this process, they've taken billions and billions of dollars and given it as a gift to the banks, and that money does not go back to the taxpayer in the form of the U.S. Treasury. So that means that the U.S. Treasury has less money to offset the bills that they have, which they sell bonds to cover, and at the same time, this is a giant subsidy by the Fed to the banks of which own the Fed. Now, you talk about incest. This is a wonderful example of the incestuous relationship that exists between the Fed Reserve and its 12 owners, the 12 Federal Reserve banks, and their major owners are, going back a century, major financial families, both in the United States and Europe. Most people don't know that. I mean, how can you have an entity that is befriend with inside information? Think for a moment. All these people at these major banking institutions and brokerage firms, they make the decision, all those decisions, and through the FOMC, they tell the Fed in Washington what to do. Well, they've already acted upon it. A wonderful example is they decided to run the dollar up just about a year ago. And I saw them go long the dollar and short the euro. And of course, the dollar went up and the euro came down. They sold their longs and covered their shorts. They made untold amounts of money. Now, they obviously decided the dollar was going to go back down, and they knew it had to. And the reason it had to is that the buyer of last resort, which had probably bought about $500 billion worth of treasuries last year, were going to have to buy another $500 billion in addition to this toxic waste that they were buying, in addition to agency bonds, Fannie, Freddie, Ginnie, and FHA. And they knew that that would drive the value of the dollar down in that process. So what do those major firms do? They get short the dollar and long the euro. And they caught it on both sides again. And they're leveraged 100 to 1. So their profits are unbelievable. At the same time, the world investor, particularly American and European investors, are getting their feet screwed into the floor. And this is the sort of thing that goes on when you have a privately owned central bank like the Fed. And Britain has the same thing, has since 1688 or something like that. It's just a license to steal. And so this whole thing was a setup to make piles and piles of money, and it worked. And now they're trying to extricate themselves and sort of slough it off and say, no, this is not a serious thing. We can go right along and kick the people out of their homes. I've yet to hear them say they shouldn't have been there in the first place, but I'm sure that's coming. And so that's really the basis and the groundwork for one of the greatest swindles in history.
That's exactly right. And it's also exactly right that they'll always try to blame the victims for being victimized by this system, which is set up for fraud in so many ways that it's difficult to even enumerate them all. But I'll give just another example of the way in which this foreclosure crisis was deliberate fraud. And that's the investment banks who were buying these mortgage-backed securities from the banks that were selling them. Had hired a company called Clayton Holdings to do due diligence on these mortgage-backed securities to test the mortgages, or at least portions of the mortgages in them, to see if they really were what the banks were claiming they were. And the Clayton Holdings found that the banks were actually lying about this, and in fact the mortgages were much less stable than they were being portrayed as. And instead of using that as a basis for rejecting these mortgage-backed securities, the investment banks then negotiated a lower price and then sold them on to the investors without letting them know about those due diligence tests that were conducted on the mortgages. So it's just yet another example of yet another layer in which these mortgages are being used for fraud behind the scenes without the actual people living in the houses having any conception of what's going on behind the curtain.
That's right, and it's tragic. And I think, you know, I've discussed this with people with MBAs and PhDs, and they don't seem to get it. The only question that really lies deep within my mind is, did they do it deliberately? And, you know, we'll probably never know unless we can get somebody to say, yeah, we did that because we wanted to do a job on the American and European economies, because we would like to see them in a less healthy and more precarious state, because we want to have world government, and that would be one way of forcing people to accept it. And I think that is at the very, very heart and basis of what we've experienced over now over 3 years. And actually, the felonious acts were created 3 and 4 years before that during the lending process.
Exactly, during the inflation of the bubble. It seems to me that after 9/11, there really does seem to have been a period in which whatever forces are directing the economy has said the gloves are off and that anything is fair play. And it seems that there's just been looting on unimaginable scales going on ever since.
Well, I think the reason for that is that they have been in the process of self-destructing the system. And very few people will come to that conclusion. And the reason why is they haven't read the history of banking and what they've done over the centuries. And they've always tried to create situations where not only did they make a great deal more money, but made a great deal more powerful position for themselves. And often within the confines of banking within economies, they've made mistakes. There's a couple of classic examples, the Lombard collapse in 1348, and then in the early 1600s, the collapse of the Hanseatic League. There's been many others, but they've been smaller in nature and weren't as profound in what they caused within Europe during those times. But these people are just doing this over and over again. And nowadays, today, because the world's a much bigger place than it was in 1348 and in the early 1600s, they have decided that they know better what's good for everybody, and they want to have world government. And the only way they can make people accept that is by collapsing the major economies of the Western world, and in all probability at the same time, as a cover, have another war. Because you see, when you have war, you do two things. You get rid of people, which they're very anxious to do, and also you deflect the thinking process when two people who have children, let's say in their 20s, have their children taken and they have to go off to a foreign war, they're more concerned about the survival of their children than they are the economic and financial problems at home, which they seem to be able to live with. I know I lived through the Second World War, and you know, everything was for the war effort. And so people lived far differently than they would have normally. And so the opportunity to be used by the people who are behind the scenes controlling things is presented for them when they create war, which incidentally, more often than not, they're financing on both sides. And so that's the syndrome that we're in. And the mortgage crisis, as we've seen it, the credit crisis, is something that was manufactured in order to reach that end. And yes, there's a great deal of risk for the people who are creating these kinds of situations, but they think that risk is worth it. And so that's why we are where we are in this episode today.
Absolutely, and it's certainly a calculated risk, knowing that the Federal Reserve really is their zombie that they can direct in whichever way they wish. And I think the latest example of the bank's controls over Congress is recent legislation, which, as I understand it, would basically allow the banks to foreclose any way they want, using whatever fraudulent paperwork they want to present. And that actually did pass the House, and Obama has done a pocket veto on that legislation. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, from what I understand, his use of the pocket veto is illegal, and this will arise again after the election. It's done to create a quiet period. And once the election's over, then the can of worms will be opened again, and it won't affect the election as much as it should. I don't think it's a partisan issue, and the reason why is that both Democrats and Republicans, and they make up the majority of Congress, there's few independents, and they have all, with the exception of perhaps 50 people, they're all getting paid off. I mean, if you go back in history just within the last 50 years, does anybody ever remember congressmen voting on bills, by and large, that they'd never even seen the bill, never mind read it? And when you have the Speaker of the House tell you that, look, it's a wonderful bill, our medical reform bill, vote for it, and we'll show you what it's all about later.
Now, it would be funny if you were joking.
Pardon me?
It would be funny if you were joking, but that is an actual quote.
That's right, more or less. And the audacity, the criminality, the position that they think that they're in regarding power in America versus the American people, you know, all I can think of when I think of that is Cicero. And he was the same arrogant sort, a brilliant author, and one of the finest speakers in the history of mankind that we know of. And he picked the wrong side, and so they chopped his head off. They don't do that nowadays because criminality so greatly embraces our culture. This is worldwide, mind you. This criminality is so deeply entrenched in every society that they don't chop people's heads off anymore or hang them. They don't even send them to jail. They just fine them because the state is more interested in collecting the money than they are paying $50,000 a year to keep this bird inside of a cage. And so this is what we have degenerated to. I mean, recently saw Goldman Sachs fined $500 million. And they were happy to pay it. And they didn't admit nor deny anything. The hook, they stole over $5 billion. Now, that's nice work if you can get it. You break the law, you steal from people, you make $5 billion, and you give a half a billion back to the government to shut them up. Warren Buffett just did the same thing with Berkshire Hathaway months ago. They stole $300 million from the U.S. government by deliberately falsifying their accounting records. They paid a $100 million fine and kept $200 million. Crime pays in America. And that's what this is really all about. We have a criminally syndicated society with the nexus thereof in New York City and Washington. And it's going to continue and it's going to get worse because the American people don't know what to do. Well, maybe they should take the example of the Europeans who for the past several weeks have been in the streets saying, we're not going to do that. You're not going to change things. You're stealing everything from us, so why should we retire at 62 rather than 60? Or why should we have our salary cut by one-third? Or why should we pay more taxes so you can steal them? We have to play out the entire equation to see who's getting what and who's getting screwed. And the public is tired of getting screwed. And so you say to yourself, why haven't Americans arisen up upon their hind legs and made noises like we're not going to take it anymore? Well, the reason is their bellies aren't empty enough yet. And when that happens, watch out. And the people behind the scenes who are causing all this know that. And they're waiting for that.
That's exactly why they have 370,000 troops now committed to Homeland Security and why they're so brazenly implementing martial law on so many different fronts that it's just a disturbing situation, and there seems to be fewer and fewer ways out of it that end happily for everyone. And I think an important point that you raised there is the culture of criminality that we're being indoctrinated into, like dipping into a hot bath and just getting used to it after a certain stage. I think that it's getting to the point where these massive, unbelievable frauds and scandals that are coming out in the economic world are even ceasing to amaze me anymore. And I think just one example of that would be Bernie Madoff, who I think in any other decade would have been a massive scandal that people would have been talking about for years. But at this point, most people don't even remember the Madoff scandal, just in light of the trillions and trillions of dollars that are being pumped out of the economy right now.
You're right, and Bernie wasn't one of the ultimate insiders, so he was sacrificed. And there was a lot more to that than the public will ever know. I think at some time in the future, an investigative reporter would put the whole story together, and he'll publish it, and he'll be liquidated. That's the way these people operate, and that's what you can expect. They kill people out of hand, like it was nothing at all. And that's because of the way they believe that life is all about. But there were hundreds of people involved in the Madoff scandal. And that's why they had closed hearings. None of the evidence was ever brought to the public. Nobody else was ever questioned except a couple of other people who work with Mr. Madoff. And Mr. Madoff is now a celebrity in jail, where he'll remain for the rest of his life. But, you know, when you're 73 years old, does it really make a big difference? I mean, you could have died at 73 anyway. And so that's why people in the latter stages of life either do two things very often. They either lead extraordinary, exemplary lives helping others, or they steal from people. And it's hard to, for the average person to countenance the mindset, the thinking of people who are so diabolically evil, the sociopathic behavior that goes back down through the centuries. It's got little to do with little things that are going on, and lots to do with a bigger picture that today encompasses our whole culture and our whole society and that of others as well. And so you say to yourself, where is it all going to lead to? And of course, if it continues the way that it is, it'll lead to revolution in many countries.
I fear that you're right, because I think that revolution can be, well, it obviously we need some sort of change in the system, but revolutionary change often just leads to tyranny that's as bad, if not worse, than before. So we have to be very, very careful about how all of this plays out. And I think that one of the important aspects of this is that a culture that is degenerating because of the psychopathic controllers at the top tends to emulate what they see at the top and thus become sociopathic and start to emulate those psychopathic tendencies that we see of those people in charge. And I think people can see that in the degeneration of society that's happening even as we speak, and the veneration of criminality that's going on so many cultural levels, I think, is a sign of the way that the society is being steered to emulate those who are currently raping and plundering the system for all it's worth. And we know how that's ended up so many times in history, with tyrants just going insane with bloodthirsty power and marrying their horse and other such ridiculous things. But unfortunately, this is the way that societies tend to degenerate, and we are watching the collapse of the American Empire, and it's not a good thing for anyone at the moment, because obviously this destabilization is just so chaotic as it's meant to be, because order comes out of chaos, as the controllers well know. So I guess the question is, what are the solutions and what are the ways forward, especially for people who find themselves in mortgages that are underwater and are currently making their payments? I mean, do you think a moratorium is on the way? What is the way out of this?
Well, I don't think there's any easy way out if the law is followed. The thing is, will law be followed? We don't know that, because there's no guarantee of law anymore. And we've seen the shortcomings of our court system. In Florida, you have one judge that says, no, we got a moratorium. And then the other side of the state, you have one federal judge that's saying, no, we're going to continue to do this. Now, you know, where does it all end? It's just like when the Fed would not give up the names of who they gave $12.8 trillion to and what kind of collateral they received. Bloomberg had to go to the federal court, and the federal court says to the Fed, you must tell them. And the Fed says, no, it's a state secret. So there was an appeal by the Fed to the appeals court where they lost. And they still won't give up the information. And now they're dragging their feet because they want to waste as much time as possible, or gain for them as much time as possible, by going to the Supreme Court, which is not going to take the case because it's pretty open and shut. But the point is that the system doesn't work, and it hasn't worked for a long time. And I've known lots of federal judges, and I won't go into how, and they certainly weren't the kind of people I would have expected them to be. And with that said, I'll leave it that way. But the point is, they weren't doing their job. And so you ask, what is going to happen? I really don't know, because I don't know how powerful a hold the banking system, the brokerage system, the Wall Street banking syndrome, I don't know how great a hold they have on the whole judicial system. And I don't know, because of that, how it's going to turn out. Anything could happen. One judge did his job and the other one didn't. I mean, the banks have committed fraud. It's as simple as that. The rating agencies committed fraud. Everybody in the AG's offices all over the country and at the U.S. Attorney's Office, they know it was fraud. But the thing that looms is, if we prosecute the fraud, the system's coming down. And I won't have my job anymore. What am I going to do? So they perpetuate the fraud because they don't like the solution. It's just like the economist, or analyst, or policeman who works for an entity. And the policeman says, no, I don't want to be federalized. He gets fired. The economist for a Wall Street firm or an insurance company or a corporation says, no, that's not right. If you do that, the economy's going to collapse. He gets fired. And the same thing with the analyst, and on and on. So people become captive of the system, and they won't speak out. And very often when they do, their lives are terminated. I mean, this is the kind of people we're dealing with here. And they've dealt this way for centuries. But coming back at the question at hand, what's going to happen? Well, number one, no one's going to jail. And number two, there'll probably be a middling of the whole thing. And I think some sort of arrangement will be made where underwater mortgages, people won't be tempted to leave their mortgage or be thrown out of their house. Something of that order is going to happen. And I don't know what formation it's going to take, because it's too early in the game yet, and it's being held over for another week or so, about 12 or 13 days, until the election's over, and we'll know better by the end of January. And, you know, you have all sorts of undemocratic things happening within our society, never mind the court system. And nothing is for sure anymore. There is no safety. You know, people say to me, well, how do I invest my money? Over the centuries, the only thing that's held its value is gold and silver. To me, it's the only place to put your assets that you don't need for daily living. And yes, gold can go up $50 in one day and down 40 the next. That's okay, because there's no place else for you to go. Do you want to go into an overpriced stock market? A bond market's in a bubble? You certainly don't want to go into real estate. You want to start a new company? Well, who are you going to sell to with 22.75% unemployment? There's not many options there. And I don't know of any other option. So that's what I say to people. If you want to save what you've got, that's what you should do. And I think that's what we're stuck in until actually the system collapses, which it will.
Which it will. Well, absolutely. And I guess what we're doing right now is just charting that collapse and seeing how it's taking place. But if people want to stay informed about what's happening, I couldn't recommend the International Forecaster newsletter any more strongly than I do. And of course, that's at intforecaster.com. Tell people a little bit about the newsletter.
Well, the letter is about business, finance, economics, social, and political issues all over the world. We've been publishing over 21 years now. And prior to that, I was in the brokerage business and owned my own firm for 28 years. And we produce a email copy on Wednesdays and Saturdays, runs around 40 pages each time. And we have a hard copy for those who are not on the internet that goes out twice a month. And you can get a free introductory copy by going to the site, The International Forecaster.com, the international, forecaster.com, or you can go to www.intforecaster.com. That's intforecaster.com. If you have a question, we answer everybody. And that address is Bob, B-O-B, at intforecaster.com. Bob at intforecaster.com. And if you'd like to call, toll free, 877-479-8178. That's 877-479-8178. And at that number, they will offer you a free one-year subscription. The deal that they have is super. It doesn't get any better than that. So if you want to become a subscriber, that's a place to go to.
Absolutely. And once again, this is just jam-packed with information, and you produce it twice a week and answer emails from so many different correspondents and continue to do all your radio interviews and just so much more besides. You have an incredible amount of energy, so my hat's off to you for all the incredible work you're doing. So, Bob Chapman, thank you once again for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's a joy to be here, and I'd like to thank all the people for reading and listening. And I can't wait to get back again.